Welcome to Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and every Monday I publish a new episode with a different climate champion as my guest. We talk about how they became motivated to act on climate change, what they are doing to help, and their vision for the future. My guest for episode 18 is Lincoln Blevins, Assistant General Manager of Power Supply at Burbank Water and Power. Lincoln has a very unique background for a utility executive, from leading international independent power projects, that's IIPP, to startups to public power, often leading multidisciplinary teams and companies to achieve complex objectives. My apologies for the sound quality this episode, but there was a loud fan noise in the building that I failed to notice until the interview started. But the discussion was great, and the building is LEED Platinum certified. Donnie, can you please explain what LEED Platinum means?
LEED Platinum is an acronym standing for Low Elemental Ebony Detection. This is going to occur as global warming increases and the ozone layer decreases. With this decrease of the ozone layer, it allows UV rays to bleach everybody's hair follicles and bleach out the dark or ebony traits, leaving everyone in a blonde or platinum blonde state.
In addition to being an expert on platinum blondes, Donnie Dunstone is the owner of Old Town Improv Company and Life Tools, Inc. in San Diego, California. There are more than just great shows at Old Town Improv. They also have classes for adults, teens, and younger children, and they facilitate improv-based corporate team-building workshops. These workshops are incredibly unique in design. They combine communication and behavior strategies with the fun, freedom, and expression of improv. Check them out at oldtownimprov.com. I was thinking LEED Platinum is when I use my upgraded version of the Midas Touch, the Krivat Touch, to transform something into platinum. Instead of being mined platinum, it would be LEED Platinum. Okay, that was bad. But actually, LEED is an acronym for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's an international certification program most often used to recognize the extent a building is environmentally responsible, such as implementing energy and water efficiency and CO2 minimization. LEED was developed by the U.S. Green Building Council and provides building architects, owners, and operators a concise framework for sustainable building design, construction, and management. Points are awarded based on the extent various sustainable strategies are achieved. The more points, the higher the level of certification. Certified, silver, gold, and platinum. If you have an alternative, entertaining definition of LEED Platinum certification, please visit my Twitter account at Lee Krivat and retweet the tweet for this episode, episode 18 with Lincoln Blevins, and retweet your definition with the hashtag LearnAterm. If you make me laugh, I'll include it in the next Climate Champions episode. That's at Lee Krivat, retweet episode 18, hashtag LearnAterm, and make me giggle. From last week's Learn a Term, ZEV program, Matthew Krivat, yes, my brother and guest from the previous episode, made me giggle by tweeting that a ZEV program is a college course on ZEV taken by Zzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzz DC. At one point in our discussion, Lincoln turns away from me and toward the mic and says that Burbank Water and Power's Integrated Resource Plan is a great read. Well, I did read the first few pages, and it is a pretty great read. But hey, I'm an energy nerd. Welcome to Climate Champions. Today I'm talking to Lincoln Blevins, the Assistant General Manager of Power Supply at Burbank Water and Power. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I really like that you had parking.
And electric car charging.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay, see, yeah. I charged at the mall. So with regard to climate change, do you have any specific moments, meaningful moments, that you feel caused you to move in the direction of trying to do something about it?
I do. Most of them are from my past life when I was doing power projects in overseas and emerging market countries. Principally, I spent a lot of time in China, both as a student back in the 80s, but then doing power projects. And one of the things that was unavoidable to me when I landed in Beijing, this is back in the late 90s, is that I would get a sore throat between the airport and the hotel. The air quality was that bad. When Hong Kong was handed back to the People's Republic in 1997, they shut down all of the industry and most of the power plants around the city of Beijing. And the folks in Beijing who lived there saw, some of them saw a blue sky for the first time that they could remember. And this was a real turning point for me because I had never really thought about it in such dramatic terms and seen it in such dramatic terms. And that experience has been replicated really all over the world, where you have a whole lot of coal-fired generation, for example, where you have a lot of unregulated auto emissions. And then, of course, moving to Los Angeles about 7 years ago, growing up in and around Chicago, all I knew of LA was basically chips and Rockford Files and smog. That's literally all I knew. And it's incredible to hear the stories from my colleagues and my neighbors of what LA used to be like not that long ago. The schools would actually have days where the kids had to stay inside because the air quality was so bad. And then finally, the other thing that really brings climate change home to me is Superstorm Sandy. I moved from the New York suburbs to the LA suburbs in November of 2012, and it was right after Superstorm Sandy. Now, we were in the northern suburbs, so we just had a six-day outage.
Just a six-day outage.
It sounds funny to say, but just a six-day outage. We didn't see what happened. You know, we didn't see the sort of catastrophes that happened closer to the city, in the city, in northern New Jersey. That brought climate change and the effect of climate change on storm patterns, and it reframed it for me as an existential threat. Maybe not for our species, because I think we'll figure it out, but for our societies and our economies, if nothing else. The kind of cost that we're talking about to mitigate it, and especially the kind of cost that we're talking about if we don't mitigate it. Imagine Manhattan, lower Manhattan, flooding every couple of years. You can't get your mind around it, let alone San Francisco, let alone Bangladesh or the Pacific Islands. You don't have the economic resilience, perhaps. So it's gotten to a point for me, just since Superstorm Sandy, where it's really gone from more of a pollution-driven concern to really more of a global climate change concern, because I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yeah, you kind of started out talking about the pollution.
Yes.
Where your eyes were burning, where you're getting a sore throat, and now it's moved into the impact that it's having on the world.
And that to me is really, that's my journey. That's my climate journey. And you know, others certainly have you know, picked up on the seriousness and embraced the seriousness of it before I did. Having now seen it with my own eyes, I'm truly committed to that.
Is there a reason it's personally important to you beyond that?
It sounds a little bit corny, but I worry about the world that we're going to be leaving for our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids. There is simply no way for me to imagine the sort of dislocation, economic and social and otherwise, and just in terms of health impacts, for example, that we are leaving our children with. We are leaving our children with a debt that they did not create. Again, it sounds a little bit formulaic. That is my biggest concern. We are running up a bill that we don't have to pay, and our children are going to be stuck with that bill.
It's quite daunting. I just read an article that it used to be that I think it was 80% likely that children would make more money, do better than their family before them, and now it's flipped to 20%.
Yeah.
Do better. Now we're handicapping them even more by making them pay for this.
That's my concern. You know, obviously, you can when you think about I'm an infrastructure person, so that's one of the ways that I view the world. But when you think about the infrastructure that is going to need to be built, even seawalls in New York Harbor, just to take that as an example.
That's proactive.
It's proactive.
But if you don't do that, then the reactive is even more.
Right. And yeah, you know, that's an asset you could finance and amortize over decades, but it's going to be enormously expensive. And so our kids, they will be paying for a solution to a problem that they didn't cause.
So when you meet people that don't see it the same way as you do, how do you explain it in a way that they maybe can understand it?
That to me is one of the most difficult challenges, if not the most difficult challenge. You know, the solutions are largely known in terms of greenhouse gas reduction in particular, and how to achieve that greenhouse gas reduction. The biggest challenge for me, and I think for everyone, is understanding and embracing a problem that is far bigger, ultimately, than any one of us. As people, we have a very easy time understanding things where there's a very direct cause and effect at our own personal level. To the extent that, you know, I buy a car that has worse gas mileage, I pay for more gas. You know, that's personal cause and effect. When you talk to someone, though, about climate change, you're really describing a problem that, first of all, is global. And there are a whole lot of people in the world who don't like to think in global terms. They like to think in very local
terms. It's very difficult to think in global terms.
It is. It is. And, you know, folks say that, you know, there's no planet B, and that's correct, but I don't think most people think in planetary terms to begin with. But also, it's the solutions at a personal level, whether they be switching to an electric vehicle or switching into LED lights or a more efficient air conditioner or what have you. Those things require a personal investment, but the return on that investment from a climate perspective is not obvious, or maybe not even measurable. Obviously, they all add up.
It might barely touch you. It might be many others that are going to suffer much more than you.
Right, right. So it's very difficult. And, you know, the economists have all sorts of different ways to explain this. But really, you're trying to convince someone of a challenge that affects not them, not just them, not just their families, but whole communities, whole nations, and without being overdramatic, the human beings as a species. In that context, there are certain people who will never get to that point.
So do you not have a way that you try to talk about it?
It really depends on the audience. You can, when you mention climate change, I find that you can tell pretty quickly where the person you're talking to stands. And here in Southern California, I think it's more real to more of us than in some other places. But you still get people who don't see it as their own personal problem. So you're really talking, sometimes you're talking to yourself. You're really talking to them from a basic perspective of the once in a 500 year, once in a 100 year storms are now happening every few years. Every part of the country is affected, whether it's flooding in Houston or hurricanes in the Northeast or incredible drought out here in the Southwest. I think you have to make it as personal as possible for whoever you're talking to. If you're talking to a New Yorker, say Superstorm Sandy really resonates. If you're talking to somebody in California, the drought really resonates. You really have to put it in terms of weather events and weather phenomena that will affect them, that they have personal experience with. And hopefully that resonates in a way that makes them think about the planet as a whole.
When I asked you about your moment that changed you, mm-hmm. It was in essence pollution and weather, personal story, issue related. It was something that happened to you and that you experienced. And so it's unlikely that that's not going to be the way that others find it for themselves. You didn't do it by reading a bunch of statistics.
That's correct. It really had to, and maybe this is the human condition, but it really had to come out of my own personal experience for me to really embrace it. I mean, embrace it not just intellectually, but really in your gut.
And you were talking about how the person that might sacrifice to some degree might not be the same person or people that benefit from it.
I do think it's telling, though, because, you know, we always, I think it's very difficult for humans, people, not to revert to self-interest. And when you look at an existential threat like climate change, it's so difficult to get folks to move beyond self-interest and think about a community interest.
I've heard many people talk about, well, let's see India and China do it before we do it. That kind of thinking isn't going to help us very much. Everybody could have that perspective.
Well, and I'll give you a Burbank Water and Power example of the other side of that. And that is, we have this we call it the eco campus. We have stormwater capture right here in 15 feet from my office. We have green roofs. We have stormwater capture. We have drought-tolerant plants. We have basically designed this place as a showcase for sustainable architecture design. All the buildings are LEED Platinum, for example.
Very impressive.
It is. I had nothing to do with it.
That's honest.
I can't take credit. But you're
proud of it.
I'm very proud of it. And it's also something where we've done it. We've done it cost-effectively. And it works. It works both environmentally and economically. And we get groups from private citizens and governments and other utilities, literally from all over the world, who come here to see how we've done it. We haven't just talked the talk, we've walked the walk. And lo and behold, it works both environmentally and economically. And that, to me, is a microcosm of the make China and India go first question. Here in the U.S., we have the capital, we have the brain power, and we have an opportunity to innovate. And just because someone else, some other country, is taking a different path doesn't mean we shouldn't do the right thing. Because if we can do the right thing and show it's economically sustainable and environmentally sustainable, then others will follow. Others will use that as an example. Others will build on that and do it even better. So that to me is the mentality that we've tried to adopt here in Burbank. And in our little corner of the world, it's been pretty effective.
So we can lead because we have the skill and the capital to do it. We should lead because it's the right thing.
Yes.
And it's actually very important that we lead because we want to own that technology. We want to be the ones being paid to help change the world.
As a capitalist, I would agree with that idea,
yeah,
too.
I'm okay if someone else does it, but I would think we would want to.
I think we do. And, you know, that's one of the things that this country is so great at, is innovation. And there's no reason why we can't prosper from the innovation that addresses climate change in the same way that we've prospered from the innovation that has electrified our society and taken our society from an analog base to a digital base.
So you talked about LEED Platinum and how you did not do that. So what do you do?
I am, as you mentioned before, the Assistant General Manager for Power Supply. So I have a wonderfully wide-ranging job. In my group, we have power production, which includes a couple of power plants here on the campus. We have renewable procurement. So we have shares in wind, solar, geothermal, biomethane projects all over the West. We're in charge of our transmission rights that bring everything into Burbank. We do the real-time system operations, which has gotten me very up close and personal with the challenges of intermittent resources, particularly solar, and how to maintain reliability in a cost-effective way when you have solar projects that come on when the sun comes up and switch off when the sun goes down. And if it's a cloudy day, are bouncing on and off throughout the day. And of course, the electric power system doesn't like that. Physics doesn't like that. So that's one of my teams is working actively to keep the lights on, keep the voltage constant while all that happens. And then I'm also in charge of all of the long-term planning. In the utility business, we call it integrated resource planning.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually just finished our latest integrated resource plan back in December. A great read, actually, especially the first two chapters, which are good summaries. it's all about this challenge of maintaining.
I like how you looked at the recorder when you said, a good read. You
want a great read.
Like you were talking to people. I'm right here.
we're all about reliable, affordable, sustainable electric supply. And it's a fascinating challenge to look forward 20 years and try to figure out, okay, how do we maintain reliable and affordable supply for Burbank while at the same time, our fossil plants start going away and we start replacing them with more and more and more and more renewables. And our greenhouse gas footprint, which is already very low, keeps going down and down and down and down. In a context of incredible change in this industry, I like to think that the industry is going to change more in the next 10 years than it has in the last century. I really believe that's true. But, you know, when we look forward and we plan 20 years, I have to think, okay, 20 years ago, 1998, 1999, that was, Britney Spears' first hit single was in 1998. I mean, that's how far back you're going. The world was a very different place. With the rate of change that we have now, looking forward 20 years and imagining the technologies and the policy mandates and how people use electricity, I wouldn't be surprised if pretty much every new car sold was electric in 20 years. In fact, I'd be surprised if it wasn't. That's our planning challenge, and that's been a lot of fun.
You know, you talked about looking ahead 20 years and all the technology, but I also saw something else in the 20-year vision, potentially, and that is a lot more weather events. And I got kind of nervous because I started seeing the other side of the fact that we probably can't move fast enough to avert a lot of that potential disaster.
That's my understanding of the science. I worry that we are past the point of solving climate change, and we are simply trying to mitigate it, both from further climate change, but also mitigate the impacts of what climate change is going to bring us, whether it be droughts or floods or hurricanes or what have you. So I do think that over the next 20 years that we're going to be seeing inevitably more weather events. And as a utility that is based in reliability, we have to think about how do we provide the reliable power affordably and sustainably under increasingly difficult weather circumstances.
I think it's quite a challenge.
It's really quite a challenge. Yeah.
You talked a little bit before about doing work overseas before you came here. Do you want to talk a little bit more about your background?
Sure. I have a very unusual background for a utility executive. I'm not an engineer. I was a foreign language major in college, French, Chinese, and Japanese. I used to know how to swear in Swahili too, but I've forgotten all that. I spent a lot of time in Asia in 1988 in China as a student, and then teaching public school, junior high school in Japan, rural Japan after college. Went to law school for better or worse, never practiced, which was the right choice for me. Jumped pretty quickly in the early 90s, mid-90s, into the global independent power movement, which was really just starting up then. All of a sudden, you had a lot of developed country investors, including a lot of utilities, looking at emerging markets and doing privately financed power projects in the emerging markets. And I joined a utility affiliate called Illinova Generating and ran Asia for them, did some work, some projects in China, tried to do some things in India, tried to do some things in Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, and also ended up doing a project that's still operating down in Panama. But really got into that. That was a wonderful, it was a really exciting time because when you look at emerging market economies, electricity is really a lifeblood. And if you can provide reliable electric supply, you really catalyze economic growth, and with it, society gets better, healthcare gets better, all the basic metrics. From there, I did some mergers and acquisitions work for power plants in the U.S., as well as a stint at a utility in New York called Central Hudson Gas and Electric, where I was first the one-person M&A shop, and then corporate secretary and assistant treasurer while Sarbanes-Oxley was happening. And then I did a lot of work, again, on the power plant development side in the Middle East and North Africa, first with a private equity fund and then with my own company. We were trying to move the technology needle on renewable projects. We were trying to make things like solar power towers, not like the one you have out on the 15 heading to Las Vegas, but 10 square kilometers of glassed-in trench with a 1 kilometer tower in the middle of it. You would have wind turbines essentially embedded in the tower so that the sunlight would heat the air underneath the glass. There was a very successful pilot project in Spain that we were trying to replicate on a larger scale in Tunisia and in Oman. We're also looking at ways to bring solar thermal into natural gas combined cycle projects. We were trying to cross the last frontier of independent power, which was technology risk. Certainly a lot of missteps, but also some very difficult circumstances in terms of the Great Recession. And then the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring happened, and the risk perception in the Middle East and North Africa went off the charts. It was time to seek other employment.
How about successes?
It's probably easier to focus on the ones nearer term, but that project I mentioned in Panama was a big success. This was 1998 or 99, I think, late 90s. And Panama was in the process of disaggregating or selling off its state-owned distribution. At the same time, because of the way that El Niño, La Niña was happening, their power system was really in a very difficult place. They didn't have the water behind the dams that they needed to meet their loads. So they put out a tender for about 100 megawatts of, at that time, oil-fired generation. And my company, along with another small company, competed against, at that time, the giants of the industry, including Enron. But we ended up winning that bid. And against enormous time pressure, because the only way we would actually get paid for the power is if we got the power plant up and running within an incredibly short time. We got that project done. It turned out to be a very, very good investment for my company and the other company who invested. But it also turned out to be a great thing for Panama. And in fact, what I've heard is that it's still, 20 years later, it is still the most efficient thermal generator in Panama. So to be able to come in and, you know, I have no hair now. I had a little bit more then, but, you know, I lost some of it.
We have a beard.
I do. But, you know, it was one of those things where you absolutely go 1,000 miles an hour for a little over a year, project financing the whole nine yards, and get something done that is really a win for everybody.
But the projects that are memorable are always the ones where you really worked hard.
Yes.
Like really hard. Yes. And sacrificed and had a team that did it with you.
And that's the key thing, is that every success in my life has been the result of really leading a great team. And there is that kind of trial by fire effect where you get to know people really, really well, which is a lot of fun. But at the same time, there is a feeling that comes along with that. It's not just a professional memory, but it's an emotional memory that you carry with you. More recently, we've had a lot of success positioning Burbank Water and Power in relative to the larger California market, in particular, Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which is our balancing authority. We're not actually part of the California ISO. So we've been able to work out a relationship, and I had the honor of leading that team, work out a relationship with LA that really modernized our relationship, but I'm also confident that even though it was a real challenge and a real process to get through, we've improved the institutional relationship, but also the personal relationship between people in the two institutions. So that's been a real win lately and has allowed us to do the sort of planning and positioning that we need to make that renewable, that affordable, reliable, sustainable future happen.
Speaking of that 20-year vision, can you talk about that vision in more depth?
I think it's easiest and most accurate to talk about this in terms of the state of California. I think other states, New York, Massachusetts, you know, there are a number of others who are doing a lot of, great things. I think California and Hawaii, Hawaii's a different kettle of fish because they're an island, a series of islands, but California is really, really on the leading edge. And I think California, like Burbank Water and Power, we want to do it right, and then let other people copy what we're doing. I really think that's...
Other states do brag that they're going to wait and let California do it and make the mistakes, and then they'll copy us.
And we have made some mistakes. The power crisis of about 18 years ago is a good example of that. But by and large, we've been able to vastly ramp up renewables, vastly ramp down greenhouse gases in the power sector, keep electricity relatively affordable, keep it very reliable, and... We still have, I think, the seventh largest economy in the world, and the economy is growing. So there have been missteps. There will always be missteps. But I really do think that, California is on a path to show the rest of the country and maybe the rest of the world, you know, how things can be done successfully, that kind of 360-degree success that we're really after. So when I look out 20 years, I don't see a change from a policy perspective. We're ramping up renewables, and that's an incredibly good thing, but renewables are really a tool, not a goal. Greenhouse gas and air pollution are the goals. We're ramping up renewables, but at the same time, we're ramping up energy efficiency. We're ramping up things like electric vehicles, ideally electric space heating, electric water heating, more efficient air conditioners, more efficient buildings, more efficient homes. And I see that accelerating. At the same time, I see the economy and the society becoming ever more reliant on electricity as a basic fuel for the economy and the society. 20 years ago, charging was something you did with a credit card, not with a car or a cell phone or these other things that we can't live without. Yeah. And I think that we keep moving in that direction. So one of our challenges is to keep electricity affordable and reliable at the same time that we move forward with electrifying our society and our economy. Frankly, you look at a trucking business, for example, they're not going to invest in electric trucks unless they can look forward and see reliable, affordable power for the foreseeable future. You know, some will, but the vast swath of the economy probably won't, or they'll wait. And so we'll get, you know, more diesel emissions, et cetera. And to me, transportation is where the big change happens. If you look at the greenhouse gas charts in California, not only is transportation by far the largest sector as a greenhouse gas emitter, but it is growing. Its greenhouse gas output is growing at the same time that the other sectors are shrinking. So transportation is really the elephant in the room. And to the extent that we can keep electricity reliable and affordable, and the technology continues to advance, not just in passenger cars, but in medium-duty and heavy-duty vehicles, we're in a great position to turn that greenhouse gas curve for the transportation sector in the right direction.
Well, for transportation to do it, zero-emissions fuel has to become a dependable, reliable commodity.
Yes.
Like you said.
It has to be, yes. It can't be a question mark. It can't be a question mark, either in terms of price or reliability. If you need to fuel up your truck, you know, if you need to plug in your semi, you need to know that the electricity is going to be there. And, you know, the other thing that in California that's helped us really think about this is something that the Sacramento has come out with this new phrase or new classification, environmentally disadvantaged communities. And these are communities that have worse air quality as compared to neighboring communities. And there's a threshold for determining that. When we look at the city of Burbank, which is crisscrossed with freeways, as every other city in California is, the environmentally disadvantaged communities are the ones right next to
hugging the rails,
right next to yeah. right next to the cars. And so when you look at the greenhouse gas impact of electrifying transportation, you get that benefit. But then you think about the ability of folks who live near highways, near industry, to breathe the same clean air as the folks who live in the more affluent neighborhoods. That, to me, is not just desirable, but it's necessary. And so I think we can actually solve a lot of problems with electrification that are separate but really go hand in hand.
And when does the majority of transportation in California run on clean fuel?
I think we will see, if it's not the majority, I'm going to be very bullish here. I believe that by 2030, most cars will be electric cars.
That's extremely bullish.
In other words, you will look around and again, it's not because of a state mandate, but because the economics are such that the cost of the cars have come down and the cost of electricity has stayed relatively low. And so it is just the range of the cars has gone up. So you get to a point where, of course, you buy an electric car. It becomes an economic decision that is a no-brainer to broader society, in the same way that the environmental driver is a no-brainer to a much smaller group right now. That's very bullish. I guess my scenario B there would be by 2030, we would see the tide definitively turning, so that there would still be a lot of gasoline cars on the road, but the cars that were being sold new were overwhelmingly electric. You know, when I think about the terminology we use, I would love for the phrase electric car to go away and just be car. I would love for the phrase renewable energy to go away and just be energy.
That's great. That's a great vision.
That's where we need to get.
I like it. So do you have any questions for me?
I'm curious how my view of the world, being a utility person, I'm very environmentally driven, but I'm also responsible for keeping the system reliable and keeping it affordable. So I have a slightly different view, perhaps, than someone who isn't as close to the actual operation of the system. How do my answers compare to others you talk to who have a different view of the system?
Well, here is what I'm very excited about. Not very much. Okay. And the reason that's so important is because one might expect that you would have more doubts about how to get to a system that is sustainable, has clean energy, has clean zero emission transportation, and is still reliable. And yet you believe that it can be done. And not only do you believe it can be done, what's come across is you feel responsible for bringing it about.
I do.
The other people I've talked to feel responsible, but by bringing new technologies to market, where you're the person who's going to vote on those technologies, find a way to bring them into where they're actually being used and actually doing what the other folks have as their vision.
Yeah.
But the vision is similar and where you want to go is similar. And I love that. And I love talking to a utility person that wants to make that happen.
We did some work around our integrated resource plan late last year, where we looked at what it would take to truly run Burbank on 100% renewable. You know, a lot of cities will claim 100% renewable energy, but they're leaning on other parts of a larger system for reliability. It's not apples to apples comparison. If Burbank were to run on 100% renewable energy, our electric rates would go up 300%, 400%, 500%, which kind of blows through your affordability argument in terms of electrifying the rest of society. But also the other side of that is that our modeling only went out and our assumptions only went out to the fourth hot day of a heat wave. And to the extent that you have a heat wave and your solar panels are running full steam, obviously, but also your batteries, the battery storage that you might have is discharging at full steam. And then there's no sun at night, obviously. So the whole system is struggling to recharge batteries during the day. We still found a very substantial risk of the lights going out, everything going out, on day five. We're starting to look at natural gas fire generation, for example, moving from its original role as a baseload 24/7 generation to its current role as more of a renewable integration machine to a future role as almost a large-scale emergency generator.
We should get together in 20 years and see.
We should.
And talk about it.
We should, yes. We'll first have a very good laugh at how little of this came to pass.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about we haven't covered?
I don't think so. This has been really informative. It's great to be able to share ideas, but also get ideas. This is really one of my favorite things about the industry and the time that we're living in, is that we've got so many bright people from so many different disciplines and so many different perspectives trying to address this this existential challenge.
On that note, I'm going to wrap this up with a rap. You went to China and got a sore throat, and it wasn't from the breeze. It was the pollution from the power generation when you worked overseas. This is a LEED building, so water doesn't drip down the drain. You leverage solar, and you leverage biomethane. You speak many languages. You used to swear in Swahili, and in 20 years, you think the world will all be EV. Back in the day, LA had to stay inside with their kids, but in the future, we look forward to renewable and reliable grids.
Wow.
He said,
don't,
wow.
Don't quit your day job. That was very good. You could be the world's first environmental rapper.
I loved Lincoln's visionary comments about the terms electric vehicle and renewable energy becoming vehicle and energy in the next 20 years. Hey, I call my mobile smartphone iPhone 7 my phone, and it didn't take that long. If you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know. Donnie Dunstone, my Learn-A-Term guest for this week's episode, is the owner of the Old Town Improv Company in the Old Town section of San Diego. If you're in town and you want some great laughs and some great restaurants, please get tickets and drop by. If you email me first, I'll confirm when I'm performing, whether I have a discount code for you, and usually both. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.crivatenergyinnovations.com and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Lincoln has the extremely difficult job of running a reliable, safe, efficient, and now clean and sustainable grid. Lincoln and his team are aggressively moving forward and confronting this challenge. Utility leadership like Lincoln's and his understanding of the urgency is critical to help mitigate climate change.